This podcast is brought to you by Brunner Communications, your best resource for public speaking, presentation, and storytelling skills. Visit lizbrunner.com and take your skills to the next level.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to Live Your Best Life with Liz Brunner. I'm Liz, and my goal with each episode is to share stories of people who are recreating their lives or rising above challenges to write their next chapters with authenticity. These stories give me the courage to go after living my best life, and I think they will do that for you too. If you like this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to the show, so this podcast can continue to inspire next chapters all over the world.
Professional baseball player, stand-up comic, even equine veterinarian. These are just a few of the, quote, misguided career chapters, as my guest calls them, that he says he considered before finding his true passion and destiny. Today, he's a world-renowned, multiple award-winning chef and restaurateur who says he is a forever student, but also a teacher. Chef Michael Schlau, welcome to my podcast.
Oh, thank you, Liz. Thanks for having me on. That was quite the introduction. Thank you.
Well, we've been friends for a long time, so it's really nice to have you on the show, and I know a little bit of your background. You truly are one of the most influential and respected chef restaurateurs in America today. What is it about being a chef restaurateur that excites you?
That's a loaded question because there are so many things that go into the job. And I think one of the things that I love most about the job is just how it isn't a one-dimensional job. It isn't like I only do one thing. You really get to be an artist. You get to be a business person. You get to be a historian, a student, a teacher, a psychologist, a babysitter. There's so many things that go into it that really make it fun. And at the end of the day, though, what we really are doing is we get to throw a party every night.
I did not expect the babysitter, but that's an interesting and I think correct description. Michael, you have won numerous prestigious awards, including Best Chef in Northeast by the James Beard Foundation, as well as the Culinary Award of Excellence given out by Robert Mondavi to only 6 recipients a year. Your restaurants have been recognized as some of the best in the world by Esquire, Food and Wine, Condé Nast Traveler, and Gourmet, just to name a few. And you cook dinner for the legendary Julia Child on her birthday, not once, but twice. What was that experience like for you?
That was a treat, Liz. I'll never forget the first time that Julia walked into one of my restaurants. It was the first restaurant I had in Boston. It was Cafe Louis. As a cook, let alone as a chef, she was it. She was the epitome and the star in everybody's eye. And she was so generous and so nice and so much fun to be around. So getting to cook for her on her birthdays, that was really cool. And as cool as that was, unbeknownst to me, when I was lucky enough to win the Food and Wine magazine's Best New Chefs in America, the award was given out in Aspen. It was my birthday and my parents came. And who hands out the award on my birthday but Julia Child? I mean, you just couldn't ask for a better birthday present than that. So we were very lucky to have her in Boston for as long as we did. And I got to go to her house for drinks and snacks and things like that. So it was a very special treat anytime you were in contact with her, let alone to cook for her. But those were always a little bit more nerve-wracking because you wanted them to be great and for her to enjoy it.
I can't even imagine. Besides Julia, who are some of your other favorite chefs?
Well, I'll always be indebted to three of my mentors, Chef Craig Shelton, who was a really talented chef, still working in the industry. Jean-Louis Paladin, who unfortunately passed away quite a few years ago, was a mentor. And the person that I credit with really giving me my start when it comes to Italian cooking is a chef restaurateur. His name is Pino Luongo, who still has restaurants in New York. And those three really helped shape my career. So many of my friends are chefs also. So it's an industry where I think our personal and our professional lives really are intersected constantly. And so some of my best friends, almost all of my best friends are chefs.
Let's go back in time a little bit, Michael. Originally from Brooklyn, New York, oldest of 3 siblings, and you describe growing up in a very tight-knit family, rather well-to-do, but around the age of 10 years old, your biological father abruptly left and you worshiped him. How did that change your life?
Well, it changed everything. I mean, it changed where we lived, changed our economic and financial means. We went from being very comfortable, is the word I would use. When he left, he left. Like, we didn't see him. And it was a very tough time. You know, I'm a young man, a young boy, really, who needed both of his parents. And my mom, she filled in and did an amazing job of taking care of us. But financially, we were strapped because when he left, he sort of left us high and dry. And we were actually on welfare for a little bit. The government was helping us. They would give me these little coins and that would buy me my school lunch. But I remember back then, even like, you know, it was a special line for the kids who didn't have the money for the regular lunch. And it was a tough time, but my mom never let us know how poor we were. And it was at this time that I started to like to cook also. So they sort of coincided and I would make things that were in the refrigerator all the time. And but it definitely affected me very much so to not have, you know, my father figure around at that pivotal age.
Your mom eventually remarries and Ned adopts you. At first, you know, like many kids, don't accept the other partner in the life, but he never, ever gave up on you. What did you learn from him?
Oh, everything. The person I am today, my parents, Ned, who was my stepfather, he actually adopted me when I turned 40. It wasn't, you know, in my youth. My brother, my sister and I, he was our stepfather and he was great to us, even if you're fighting them during that time. So when he first came into my life, I was like, who are you? You're not my dad. You can't tell me what to do. And he just wouldn't give up. And he was constantly teaching us life lessons and about integrity and honesty and how to be a good person. He was relentless. He was a special human being who I ended up very much looking up to him. And today he passed away almost 11 years ago. I find myself certainly thinking about him on a daily basis. And those life lessons, they just keep coming up where I say, you know, my dad used to say, but they are important to me. And when I gave his eulogy, I remember saying all these descriptors about my dad, but the last one was the most important, and that was the word integrity. He really taught me that without integrity, you have nothing. I think about that, not just in my daily personal life, but in my professional life. We all make mistakes. Are you at least trying to do the right thing with every step? And if you're trying your best, nobody can fault you if you make a mistake. But it's acknowledging that mistake and then not repeating it. That was like one of his big life lessons, is you can't learn if you don't fail. And it's okay. You just got to keep going and pick yourself up. And he was great about that sort of stuff. He really was. And my mom the same way. My mom's still with us and she's a fantastic cook. And I give her all the credit in the world for instilling the love of food in not just me, but my whole family.
Well, let's get back to food too, because you wanted to get some extra cash. You were growing up and one of your first jobs, you were a dishwasher at the age of 14, kind of learning the restaurant business that old fashioned way from the bottom up, just about working every single job that there possibly was in the restaurant business. What I think is so interesting is that despite that early introduction, Michael, to the restaurant business, you still had other dreams. One of them was to be a professional baseball player, and you were quite good at it. Getting a baseball scholarship to play in college, what did you love about the game that made you say, that's what I want to do?
I liked baseball, and I enjoyed it. I loved the competition of it. I enjoyed winning when we were doing well. And I wasn't a sore loser, but I certainly didn't enjoy losing. I know nobody does. I'm so lucky that that was not my career and that I ended up where I ended up, which is this amazing life of being in the restaurant business and traveling the world and getting to feed people. It's a very unique business. And I'm very, very lucky that this is what I found.
You admit that while you were in college and doing this baseball thing, you took easy courses. Somehow you found another
very
passion.
Easy courses.
You found this other passion of doing stand-up comedy and doing open mic nights and absolutely loving it, running into some of the best comics in New York City. Who'd you rub elbows with?
Well, that was an interesting, very, very brief moment in my life. My whole family is sort of entertainers. My mom went to the high school for performing arts, and my sister was in movies and on plays. And so it sort of runs in the family. And I was taking this easy class to just get credits because I didn't want to go to school. And I only wanted to play baseball and, like, you know, watch soap operas and party with my friends. And that was the extent of my college. I was not a good student because I wasn't interested in it. But I was good at this improv class that I was taking. And my teacher thought that I was funny. I don't know how or why, but they did. They signed me up without my knowledge to an open mic coffee house amateur night sort of thing. And I ended up winning the amateur night. And I went to New York and I started to do these open mic nights at Catch a Rising Star, Dangerfields. And then I started to see the pros come in. I saw Jerry Seinfeld and Robin Williams. you know, getting to watch these pros, Richard Belzer, Gilbert Gottfried, and you realized, oh my God, I do not stand a chance here. These people are so good and so funny. And you realize just how talented they really are, that it's not this 5 or 10 minutes of comedy. It's another thing to make a career out of it, where you're writing hours and hours and hours of material and keeping it fresh. And so again, lucky me that that is not where I ended up, because I don't think I would have been successful long term.
I think lucky us too, because of the restaurant business. Okay, so we have one more career chapter we have to talk about, which is you in the summers were working on a horse breeding farm and even contemplated being an equine veterinarian until somebody asked you a really important question. And that question changed the trajectory of your life. What was that question?
The question is, what are you doing here? To be honest with you. So I had worked with racehorses, all forms, from a breeding farm to a racing stable. And it was a way for, especially when I was playing baseball, to keep in good shape and stay strong. And I loved being around the horses. And I still do. I take my daughter riding. I love it. And if there was a secret fantasy I have, it would be somehow to have a little farm and a horse or two or three. And I did think about at one point, was I going to stay in the horse racing industry? And if so, maybe I would become an equine vet, because that seemed like a really good profession to me. It was a steady profession. This guy who was in one of the barns that I was working in, we were just chatting one day, and he's like, what are you doing here? He's like, you do not fit in here. And I said, what do you mean? He's like, well, you're good at what you do, but I kind of see, like, with your personality, everything, you'd be great in restaurants. I'm like, well, that's my other job. I do work in restaurants. I do love to cook. And my mother had suggested my looking at culinary school. And then this other person who, you know, in the horse racing industry who I respected said, why don't you just go check it out? And when I checked out school, that's when the light bulb hit me that this is where I'm supposed to be.
What I find interesting, though, is that when you went to culinary school, you had no intention of being a chef. So what did you think you were going to do by going to culinary school?
Well, so I think this is, again, all of the actor slash comedian, famous baseball player. What am I going to do in my second chapter? Will be, I'll be in the restaurant business and I'll walk around and own the place. And so I had to figure out how I'm going to work in this restaurant industry. And will I be somebody who is more in the front of the house and be an owner or a manager? As school started, I started to really love the cooking aspect of it. And the first job that I ever had out of school was both front and back of house. So in the mornings, I would be the porter. I'd bring all the foods in, the deliveries. I'd break stuff down. I would go and work lunch on the line and, you know, make salads or whatever. But at night, I would go home, take a shower, get in a tuxedo, and I'd come back. It was a fancy French restaurant, and I would do tableside cooking. So I'd make your Caesar salad at the table, make Dover sole, crepe Suzette, all these fancy coffee drinks. And my personality was allowed to sort of come out and really have fun with this and be hopefully social and entertaining. I wasn't shy, so I didn't mind going to the tables. A lot of chefs, I think, were in the kitchen because there's a barrier. This is before the days of open kitchens. And so there was a barrier where I want to be in the business, but I don't want to talk to anybody. That wasn't me. I wanted to cook and talk. It was also very lucrative to be in the front of house doing the tableside cooking. I made a lot of money doing it as a young man just coming out of school. My dad again said to me, whatever industry you decide to go into, he said, just go work for the best. Even if that means you make a little less money, work for the best and build your foundation. And that's what I did. And it's hard today. Everybody's in such a rush to become the top person or the sous chef. It's harder to get people to stay and build a foundation. But I'll never forget this one story where I was working in a restaurant in New York called Sapori di Mare. And it's really where I learned a lot about Italian cooking. I got an offer to go to the restaurant down the street for a little bit more money, a brand new restaurant. Nobody had ever heard of it. And I remember telling my dad that I'm going to give notice. And he said, why would you leave that restaurant? You've only been there for 1 year. Are you still learning? And I said, I am. But the other place is going to offer me more money. And he said, don't take money. You know, you don't know if that restaurant's going to even be there in a year from now. Stay where you are. And I remember fighting him about it. I was like, you don't understand. It's so much more money. And he's like, stay where you are. If it's about the money, I'll lend you the money, which I ended up not taking. Luckily, I didn't want to, but I stayed in the job as he suggested. And I ended up staying for a couple of years. And that job opened up so many doors for me.
You have a wonderful cookbook called It's About Time, Great Recipes for Everyday Life, which I highly recommend, by the way. I've used a few recipes myself. And you talk about how intimidating it is in culinary school, the chefs measuring your dicing. And you also wrote in the book, graduating chef school doesn't make you a chef.
That is true.
So what does?
when I graduated culinary school, nobody wanted to eat with me. Not because I graduated culinary school, because I was obnoxious. Ugh, look at this garnish. I can't believe they're using an orange wedge here. And I didn't know anything. It's like saying you're a doctor when you get out of, you know, medical school. You have to go and do your internship. You have to study. You have to practice. And when do you become a great doctor? When do you become a great lawyer? When do you become a great chef? Great at anything. I think you have to, again, build foundation and you have to practice, practice, practice. And so one of the things I would say about when do you become a great chef, I don't know because it hasn't happened for me yet. I'm still working towards becoming a great chef.
I think there would be some people who would disagree with that.
Well, you know, I would never in a million years, and it's just the way that I was brought up, you're only as good as the last meal you cooked as a chef. Same thing as a restaurateur, the last meal you served to a guest. It's not some sort of BS that when I say it, I genuinely believe it, that this is where the student part comes in, that I am still a student. And yes, I might be able to teach some things at this point with this many years experience, but I never think of myself as a great chef. I think of myself as somebody who always has to work really hard to make the food perfect. And I am, the first competition is with myself. I don't ever look at my colleagues, like somebody will say, oh, there's a lot of competition in the area, or there's a lot of competition in the field. The way that I view it is I have lots of colleagues and there's plenty of business to go around for everyone. What sets you apart is what you do, not only for the guests, but what you do for the staff also. And that's where providing a learning environment, being a good teacher, being a good mentor, but still realizing that you're growing at the same time. And so if you can do those two things simultaneously, then I think you've got a potential for success. Modesty and humility need to be part of being a chef. You can be confident, but I'll never forget going to this restaurant that will remain nameless. And I complimented the chef on the dish. They came out of the kitchen to say hello to me. And I said, oh my gosh, you know, this was so delicious. And they said, yes, I know. And I just like was deflated, like, no, you're supposed to say thank you, not yes, I know. So it was ridiculous. And so if somebody says something's delicious, I'll say, I'm so glad that you like it. You know, I didn't cook that dish so-and-so. And I'll always give also, if I'm in a kitchen and somebody else cooked it, give that person acknowledgement. The chef doesn't cook every dish in a restaurant. In fact, they cook very few dishes in a restaurant. Most of them are done by people you'll never meet or see. And so they deserve the praise. And like when I won the James Beard Award, I said it was my name that was used, but I didn't win it. This kitchen team won it, all of the people that I worked with. Another attitude is like, nobody ever works for me, they work with me. That kind of approach about positivity, because I grew up in the restaurants where it was old school, yelling and screaming and throwing stuff at cooks was normal. I got threatened. My chef would yell at me, I'll come over there and, you know, beat your ass if you keep doing this. I always make sure that I'm trying to cultivate the next generation of chefs. If the food is not good with the next generation, it's this generation of chefs that are responsible. It's just a very different world. And I'm glad it's this way now versus the old school, because the yelling and the screaming and intimidation didn't get you motivated to work. It made you think, oh, you know, I just want to get on to the next thing. And if they call out some more food, you know, I'm just gonna leave. You would get so frustrated and so beat down, but I never let them win. I would always just bounce back. But there were lots of times that it made you question whether you wanted to do this another day or not.
Well, you've spent your entire life cultivating your craft and your ability to capture all these variety of global cuisines and techniques. And that's led to multiple television appearances over the years, whether it's The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, Bravo's Top Chef, Masters, all the morning shows, and your good friend Rachel Ray, and the Food Network. I think it's interesting that you have also, besides cultivating your craft, made such a commitment to proper technique and the purity to Tuscan cooking. You've added some Asian and French influences as well. But do you have a favorite if you had to pick one over the other?
At the end of the day, if I'm cooking at home, Italian and basic Mediterranean in general will win over. But part of that is because I just love the flavors of that kind of cooking, the simplicity of it. But there's also a soulfulness to it, especially Italian, Spanish, Greek, French. Those four in particular, they share a common thread. And it's not just the food, and it's just not the soulfulness of the food, but it's the commitment to sharing a meal. I love that about those cultures. Even if you're dining alone, you're still savoring, even if it's an espresso. There's that moment in the day when you're in Italy, if you're alone and you say, you know, I'll have a coffee. And they take time for food and for conversation and for being together. And I love that about those communities, those particular places in the world. I mean, at the end of the day, the thing that I probably enjoy cooking the most is pasta. It is my thing, like, but it literally speaks to me. It tells me when it's done. I will take a strand of pasta and I know that in about 13 seconds, it's going to be ready. And I literally count down the 13. But part of that is having worked in so many restaurants where I would work the pasta station. I think in America, people think pasta is an easy thing to make where, oh, I'm just going to get some ingredients and some pasta and mix them together. It's one of the hardest stations in any of my restaurants to work. The other one that's really hard is breakfast cookery, short order cooks. And you watch the dance that they have of the bang goes down the toast, on goes the eggs, next goes. I'm just in awe of a good breakfast cook because they are magicians.
There's choreography involved, I think, right?
Exactly. It's a dance. It's a total dance. And the other food that I think is really interesting is Japanese cooking, because especially sushi, where you're only dealing with a few ingredients, they're really exposed. So if the rice isn't cooked properly, seasoned properly, or the right temperature, if the fish isn't pristine and perfect, the right size, the right thickness, it really can throw the dish off and tumble it. So, I mean, I love all foods, but at the end of the day, if there was like one last thing, it's probably going to be a bowl of pasta.
Is there anything you don't like?
I don't like fish and cheese together.
Oh, okay.
That's all my Italian cooking background. That was just drilled into me. Italians don't do that. I don't love fiddlehead ferns. They taste like dirt to me.
Really?
I mean, you got to clean them and clean them and clean them and clean them.
Okay. I did not know they were that hard to clean.
You know, everybody gets all excited about it. I'm like, you could keep those. I don't need those in my life. They look cool, but that's about it. No, there's not a lot of foods that I don't like. You know, people say to me, it must be hard. Do you get invited over to people's homes for dinner? And the simple act of inviting somebody to their house, the meal is already good to me. I don't care if it's not well executed. You can give me peanut butter and jelly sandwich. You know, you can give me a hot dog. You can give me whatever it is that you want to make. The simple act of sharing a meal together, it's already a good meal. Contrary to the young culinary school graduate that was judging everything on a plate, I don't sit in judgment at restaurants anymore unless I think they're sort of begging to be critiqued. I would much rather enjoy my food with the people that I'm eating with than sit there and break it down and like, wow, did you think that maybe this puree should have been, you know, a cauliflower puree instead of an onion puree? I just don't do that anymore. And I just want to enjoy the meal. Also, I guess I feel like when I'm out to dinner, especially, I would like for every meal to be a good meal. Doesn't mean that it has to be expensive. We really have that wrong in this country that we somehow think if something's expensive, it's somehow better. Some of the greatest meals I've had in my life have been the least expensive. And then there's been plenty of expensive meals where the place is super uptight or it's no fun and it's expensive, but that's not a good meal just because it costs more money. And we kind of do that with everything, don't we? I mean, we sort of do it with cars or clothes or doctors. If something's expensive, we think it's automatically better. And I don't think it is. And just because you're on TV doesn't make you an expert. And I think that that's also happened a little too much in this country where, again, pick a subject, but I'll go with food since that's what I know. There are great chefs on television, and then there are great entertainers who cook. And some of them are not either.
That's a very important distinction. All right, in terms of eating, you have, I believe, 9 restaurants, Boston and DC, and you've just opened a new one in Boston at the Encore Hotel. How exciting to have a new restaurant. What's the cuisine there?
So this is a great project that I was lucky enough to get to partner with a company called Carver Hospitality, Sean Christie, who's originally from the Boston area, and his father, Peter Christie, was the head of the Mass Restaurant Association. It was just kismet and this sort of mutual appreciation of what we had both accomplished in life. And he said, would you be interested in working with us on this seafood restaurant? I jumped at the chance. So if you want some New England classics, we have those things. But if you want something a little bit more plated and a little bit, you know, more elevated, we have that too. But price has got nothing to do with the execution. Everything we touch, we are trying to do at the highest level. If we're making a lobster roll, we're trying to make you the best lobster roll you ever had. And that's a very subjective thing, you know? So some people like it hot and buttered, and some people like it cold with mayo and not too much mayo. So everything is always trying to acclimate to your guests and take good care of them. This was also fun in that gave me an opportunity to have a new home for the burger that we had made sort of famous at Radius that was in my cookbook. It was something I had never served in a restaurant before. It was just something I made for friends at home for barbecues. One day I was like, you know what, let's just put this on the bar menu and see what happens. And it turned into this monster where at Radius, we were starting to sell about 100 hamburgers a day, which was both a blessing and a curse. So
That's good. A lot of burgers. I know people will be excited to try it. Folks, if you'd like to learn more about Chef Michael Schlau's new restaurant and all of his restaurants and locations, just go to schlaurg.com. We'll have that for you in our show notes, and I can promise you, you will not be disappointed at any of them. Michael, I know family dinner time was really important to you. It certainly was when I was growing up. That's one of our similar backgrounds. I mean, we had to be there 6 p.m. That's it. You did not miss dinner.
When the streetlights come on, yeah.
What's so meaningful about dinner time?
Well, I mean, my family, especially when I was a kid, I mean, this was a time where if the phone rang, he'd answer the phone and say, Michael's eating dinner right now. You can call back in a half hour. And for me and my brother and my sister, it really was the place where we were taught patience, perseverance, how to argue a point. As I said, my dad was a lawyer, so he would mess with us constantly and try to twist the stories and get us to have to defend ourselves in a polite and respectful way. But we learned everything there, not just about food, but about life. It was that moment in the day where we came together as a family, and that was really where politics were formed, how to behave, how to be good human beings. And I remember a story got told, and it was maybe you thought you had done something that wasn't that egregious or horrible. And my father would like literally drop his fork. He's like, you did what? And then all hell would break loose because you're going to get a life lesson right then and there. So the family dinner time is really, really important. My daughter, when I have her, we sit down, we cook together, we eat together. It's very, very important that we spend those times together. And it's just a time to share the day's events. And I think it's something that I hope every family gets to do in one way or another. I know everybody's on the run, but it's important to sit down and share a meal together.
Absolutely. I love that. Michael, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. And I know people will want to check out your restaurants if they have not done so already. And since I know you're such a fan of Julia, I'm sure you know this quote, people who love to eat are always the best people. May all of you listening live your best life with people you love, and may they also love to eat like I do. Until next time, be well.
This podcast is brought to you in part by Fast Twitch Media, helping people tell their stories and giving them worldwide reach. The future is in the cloud, and Fast Twitch Media can take you there. Be your best digital self. Check out fasttwitchmedia.com. Space.